Okay, members, I think I'm going to call the Education Policy Committee to order. Please, people, take your seats. We have, despite our best efforts to try to get folks to sign up for yesterday when we had more time, we had a few more testifiers sign up for today. So we have about 18 more people to go. So I'm going to give them about 2 minutes each, and I've broken them into chunks of like five or six so we can ask some questions in between. So we don't have to wait all the way till the very end to ask our questions. So with that, I will bring down Shannon Mitchell from Educators for Excellence. Please state your name for the record and proceed, if she's here. And she missed her time yesterday, too. So we'll just move on. Sherry Munyon. All right, guys, this is going to be faster than I thought.
All right.
We're just going to keep cooking. We have the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Paul Spies, and I'm testifying today as a volunteer lead for the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota's Legislative Action Team. We'd like to thank the chair and the committee for your receptivity to the powerful testimony we had a couple weeks ago for the 2019 Increased Teachers of Color Act, House File 824. We especially thank you for including the proposed policy provisions from HF 824 in 18 sections of this omnibus bill, which will do much to strengthen the existing efforts and address key barriers to attracting, preparing, and retaining teachers of color and American Indian teachers in the state. These provisions build upon Republican-led efforts over the last two sessions and make good on the 2016 legislative promise in several statutes that all students shall have, quote, improved and equitable access to effective and diverse teachers who reflect the diversity of students in their schools. Starting with establishing a statewide goal for increasing annually the percentage of teachers of color and expecting a biennial accountability report, in many ways this bill is historic for what it will do on the policy side to address opportunity gaps and needs for systemic change, expecting different and better results. We'd like to thank Representative Kunesh Podein as lead author of HF 824 for being a great advocate of the provisions proposed and for all the bipartisan support received from 7 Republican and 26 Democratic co-authors on that bill, including 8 members of this committee. At the end of last week, I reviewed authorship of all 128 bills that had been referred to the Ed Finance Division, and the Increased Teacher of Color Act ranked in the top 2 of all bills in the House for that committee in terms of amount of bipartisanship and total authors. Since 2017, the Coalition, in close partnership with Violeta Hernandez from the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, have been working hard with stakeholders and various organizations to build consensus around the language adopted in this omnibus bill that will strengthen state investments and help ensure that students have improved and equitable access to effective and diverse teachers. In closing, I'd like to close by also thanking some of the many organizations that have united in endorsement of the Increased Teacher of Color Act, while despite sometimes having very different views on other bills. Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs, Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Minnesota School Board Association, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Association of Elementary and School Principals, Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, Minnesota Professional Education Licensing and Standards Board, Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, Minnesota Head Start Association, Minnesota Youth Council, Minnesota Parent Teacher Association, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, Children Defense Fund of Minnesota, Educators for Excellence, Equity Alliance Minnesota, Ed Allies, Education Evolving, Education Minnesota, Voices for Racial Justice, and 15 other community-based organizations. Thank you for the committee for your leadership, and thank you for your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Spies. And I This is my fault. I forgot to mention that we're going to try to keep people to 2 minutes from here on out just so that we can get through these and have time for member questions. So thank you, Mr. Spies. I also have Violeta Hernandez Espinoza on the list. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Violeta Hernandez Espinoza, and I serve as Education Legislative Director for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. We're here to share a united message about the committee's omnibus bill from the three state ethnic councils in relation to provisions from the Increased Teachers of Color Act, HF 824. Before delivering that message, with your permission, Chair Joaquim, I would like my colleague to introduce herself for the record as we will both share testimony.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Katie Sly, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, unable to attend but also included in this testimony and letter to the committee is the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. Madam Chair and members of the committee, as we testified a couple of weeks ago during the positive hearing on HF 824, the set of comprehensive policy proposals included in that bill and now in your omnibus bill are built on consensus and feedback from hundreds of community and organizational stakeholders. We appreciate the committee's responsiveness to our strong recommendations on solutions to address our state's severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers, which has been our top priority in education over the last and current biennium. The state ethnic councils and state agencies have the important role and statutory duty to advise and inform elected officials about our constituent communities and their needs. These policy amendments will do much to address many of the significant barriers to increasing teachers of color and American Indian teachers in Minnesota. Many of the policy provisions you've included in this omnibus bill will also address factors that contribute to the underachievement of students from our constituent communities.
Ms. Sy, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, we thank the chief author, Representative Kunesh Pudin, and the many co-authors of the 2019 Increased Teachers of Color Act for continuing to unite across party lines to address the severe shortage of teachers of color in Minnesota with this historic legislation. The most historic component included in your omnibus bill is the establishment of a state goal to increase the overall percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers each year, and the requirement of a report on outcomes of all related state investments. This sets a clear state commitment to addressing this issue. In addition, included in your bill are important amendments modifying the following statutes: the World's Best Workforce Exam Requirement for Tier 4 Licensure, American Indian Teacher Preparation Programs, Teacher Mentorship, Intro to Teaching Concurrent Enrollment Courses, the Achievement and Integration Program, Student Teacher Candidate Grants in Shortage Areas Program, and the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program. Once again, we thank the Chair and Committee for adopting our recommendations and for moving this comprehensive and historic set of legislation one step closer to law. Finally, a strong step towards a Minnesota well beyond 4% teachers of color and American Indian teachers, and addressing the needs of 33.5% of all Minnesota students. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hernandez Espinoza, does that conclude your testimony?
Madam Chair, we just like to say we look forward to working with members of the conference committee to ensure that these laws get, that these policies get signed into law, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I've got Josh Downham, Chris Stinson, and then Brad Lindell, if you guys could just prepare in that order. Mr. Downham, state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Down, Minneapolis Public Schools. I want to say thank you for including in Article 1 the homeless and highly mobile transportation provision. As you know, the two family shelters for homeless folks actually are in our district, so this will go a long way to helping families who become residents of Minneapolis schools. Also, we'd like to, on the foster care transportation, continue working with DHS and Representative Katiza Watoon on that language, just to clarify that that seven-day window is for students for whom it's in their best interest to transfer schools. But federal law really does focus on attempting to keep those students in their school, their home school. On the special ed provisions, Madam Chair, thank you for including the functional behavioral assessments. I understand there might be an amendment potentially that would allow families to request a comprehensive assessment more frequently than 3 years. That could pose a challenge to districts because it is such a time-intensive change or process. And on the conciliation conference, we do have a small change that we're working with advocates on that hopefully will be in the author's amendment, just to ensure that when an IEP team meeting is requested by a parent, that it be with the appropriate members of that IEP team. And then Representative Erdahl and I had a brief discussion about the civics piece, and I'm here because I took ninth grade civics and decided to change professions, or directions, I should say. And the 11th and 12th grade does pose a challenge, particularly for PSEO students, so I'd encourage you to consider carving out an exception for PSEO students. And then appreciate the working with the department on the radon and lead water testing. And then lastly, Madam Chair, very briefly on the licensure piece, and I know my superintendent has shared a letter with the committee, so I won't go in depth into that, but simply changes to Tier 1 and Tier 2. When we are attempting to recruit teachers from other states, particularly northern tier cities like Milwaukee and Detroit, will become more challenging if they can only renew their license a limited number of times and don't see a pathway to Tier 3. I have many more comments, but I think my time is up. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dunham. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Stinson. I'm the Policy Director for SEIU Local 284. We represent more than 9,000 school service employees across the state, and our local is working for a future where students in every Minnesota school have all that they need to succeed from pre-K to career. I want to start by thanking you for the changes in the nutrition article. As an organization representing school nutrition workers, we know that nutrition is critical for growth and academic success. Our food service members are the ones who are asked to deny students meals, and our clerical members are the ones who have to inform students that they'll not be allowed to walk at graduation or participate in after-school programs because of an outstanding meal balance. We're grateful, all of us are grateful for your work to prohibit those practices so that students are not stigmatized. I also want to say thank you for the changes in the special education article. We know that appropriately supporting students with special needs is critical for their development and future success. The proposed changes give special educators the ability to focus on what they're good at, which is caring for our kids. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lundell, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here on behalf today of both Schools for Equity in Education and also the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. From CEA's perspective, I think that what Mr. Downham said about the teacher licensure changes are also of concern to Schools for Equity in Education members. Again, those areas where, especially in CTE, being able to renew those licensures, a lot of those people are mid-career people, and they're just it's difficult for them to get back to school to become a Tier 3 teacher. I think the other thing, the Labor Day start is also very much appreciated, and I think especially doing that this year so that because folks plan their calendars 2 years out in advance, and I think getting ahead of the game on that is very, very important. From Mesa's perspective, I'd just like to say thank you for keep putting special ed provisions in the bill that you have in there, especially the contents of Representative Hewitt's House File 1940 on the ADSIS change. Very, very important that that barrier to tutoring for students that have a non-related individualized education plan, I think, is very important, and it is certainly going to help, again, prevent identification of those students in other areas of disability. So with that, again, I'll want to thank you for the process that you've had. It's been a very open process. We've all got a chance to say what we needed to say, and we look forward to working with you in the future. And in closing, I'd just like to say I didn't realize Mr. Donham was so advanced because he had a profession by ninth grade. And here I'm 65 and still looking for one. So.
Thank think you. What he could have done if he'd gone as a senior.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Next, I have up Barb Sanders and Bernadette Burnham, and then I think we'll move to some member questions. Do I have – oh, actually, and then we'll do Sherry Munyon after that, and then we'll move to member questions. So please come forward and state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Joaquim and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Cordes, and I teach English language learners in Robbinsdale area schools. When Minnesota changed its teaching licensing standards 2 years ago, proponents of the changes kept saying and still say that it will help attract more teachers of color to the profession. I know all too well we need more education of colors in our schools. I've been the only teacher of color in the buildings many times in my 19 years of teaching. But changing the standards isn't the way to recruit people into the profession. I went through two teaching preparation programs, the first time to switch careers and go into teaching, and the second to obtain my license to teach English learners. It was challenging, but I was determined to succeed. I learned so much from how to work with students from different backgrounds and experiences to how to differentiate my instruction and work with students on individualized education plans. Student teaching was an eye-opening for me, and even after I was done, I felt like there was still more to learn. It's insulting to me and other teachers of color to say we need to lower or change the standards to keep a teaching license. If I felt the standards were being lowered on my behalf, I would not have gone into teaching. And even more important, it's not good to put teachers with a lack of training in front of teachers, in front of students, especially with those with the highest needs. It's also troubling that under current law, Tier 1 teachers don't have the freedom to join their local bargaining unit. My union is important to me because I can advocate for my students and colleagues without fear of retaliation from administrators. How do we keep people in the profession, especially teachers of color? For me, mentoring was huge. When I started teaching, I met monthly with other teachers of color in my district. It helped me feel supported, that I wasn't alone. Minnesota can be a leader. Please support this bill so we can restore Minnesota's high standards and keep teachers in the profession. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right. My name is Bernadette Burnham. Good afternoon, Chair Joaquim and members of the committee. My name is Bernadette Burnham, as I just said, and I'm a teacher in Duluth Public Schools, currently on leave to serve as the president of the Duluth Federation of Teachers. My route into teaching was different than most. 25 years ago, I was working in my children's school as a parent volunteer, 10 hours a week, also working on the playground and heavily involved in the Parent Teacher Association. The assistant principal turned to me one day and said, "Why don't you just go and get your degree? You're great with kids and you love being here." I enrolled at the University of Minnesota Duluth and was able to get my teaching degree with the help of a Teacher of Color grant. I've been teaching 19 years and went on to earn my master's degree in education. Unfortunately, Minnesota's tiered licensure system undervalues teacher preparation and makes it optional. Minnesota needs to close the loophole that allows a candidate to obtain a Tier 3 license without having completed a teacher education program. I learned a lot from my experience as a parent volunteer watching master teachers in the classroom, but the time I spent in my preparation program learning about pedagogy, the art and science of teaching, was extremely important to my success as a teacher. Someone can know physics like the back of their hand, but does she know how to teach physics to teachers, to teenagers who learn in a variety of different ways? To actually come in, manage a classroom, and meet the needs of students is hard. You need to have that prior knowledge and training in classroom behavior, differentiated learning, and so much more. This bill makes much-needed changes to the tiered teacher licensure system by restoring Minnesota's high standards for a license, elevating teachers to keep them in the classroom, and honoring teacher preparation while recognizing different pathways into teaching. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Saunders. And I think we have Sherry Munyon, and then we're going to move to some quick member questions. And I think I had mentioned Barb Saunders, but she should be later on the list. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I'm here today representing the Literacy Action Network. And we're testifying regarding the tenure section of the bill. Literacy Action Network supports professional pay and benefits for all of our ABE teachers. However, there are a number of issues that still need to be considered and addressed if pay parity with K-12 teachers were to be achieved in order to avoid service decreases for those who are served by ABE. The skill set that is needed to teach adults is different than that needed to teach children. How will this reality be affected by the potential changes? What will prevent K-12 teachers with no adult teaching experience from bumping into an ABE environment where they might not be able to effectively meet the adult learner needs? ABE students are generally available to take classes in the mornings and evenings and not follow the K-12 schedules. When we are wondering whether union requirements such as those that provide or prohibit split shifts will apply to ABE teachers, and if so, then how will student needs be met? ABE is not funded on a per pupil basis, but on contact hours. The rate and level of ABE funding is far less than that for K-12. It is believed that significant additional funding might be required to pay district ABE employees and teachers the same rate as K-12, and we don't know where that funding will come from. As programs face an increasing teacher pay without increase in funding, they will need to drastically cut services. This is likely to lead to unmet needs within the communities and lower funding for the following year, causing a spiral effect. And just as a side note, since this is a policy committee, there has been no increase in ABE money for nearly a decade. There is no inflationary factor for our ABE programs, and they're already mightily struggling to help their adult learners. Three quarters of all of the ABE teachers are part-time. Part-time teachers can be beneficial in ABE on both sides. Many part-time teachers choose that as a part of their style, or because of their other activities, such as they may also be in school at the same time. But we are still concerned over the long term of how these teachers will be affected by potential changes in pay and contract. Will we see a growth in part-time teachers and fewer contracted teachers due to the funding pressure? Again, on behalf of LAND, their concern is for the adult learners, and will we be able to continue giving them all of the services they need? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Munyon. Members, at this time, I'd like to break real quick and see if people have any questions for those who have testified already. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't catch the last name of the person from Minneapolis Public Schools. Chris, was it Don?
Mr. Donham.
I guess I can go ahead and just ask my question now. So my district is also concerned about the civics for 11th and 12th grade. I'm glad Representative Erdahl just walked back in. And one of the things you had mentioned, I heard you mention, was a carve-out exception for PSEO students, because my district currently offers it in 9th and 10th grade, too, and I know that's a concern. But my question is, if we did a carve-out, a lot of students aren't taking those PSEO courses. Are they necessarily going to know that they're going to be in those courses in 11th and 12th grade? So you could just talk a little bit about what you were thinking on that.
Mr. Donham.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, that's actually a very good question. Very often, students don't take PSEO until their 12th grade year. Fewer take it both 11th and 12th. So what I was attempting to do is try to find, because whether it's IB or PSEO, those schedules get incredibly packed, and if we could have some flexibility for students, and we could say perhaps it's just 11th grade. I was just trying to throw some ideas out, frankly, to get some more flexibility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and of course I'm always flexible on these things. No, really, I am. And if you can come up with a suggestion that addresses this particular need, you know, I'm certainly, you know, we'll look for ways to accommodate you. I mean, the concern is that we have to have students taking this course as juniors or seniors, because it know, once again, if you're, is it a ninth grader or a senior that's best prepared to learn this subject and vote and take part in our society? And that's, in essence, what this is about. The way we're doing it now is not working. And so if you have some ideas on addressing this particular need of PSEO, you know, we can look at ways to make it work.
Thank you. Any other questions for members, or can we move on? Rep. Seth Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Spies, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Spies, I'm looking at page 27 on the reporting requirement under the teacher section, in specifically increasing teachers of color. And looking at your reporting mechanism, I find that the language is rather broad, and yet you have referenced several statutes. So just explain to us how you envision this report to read after, well, starting in 2019, they have to collect, or they have to collaborate, and then they have to summarize. So just explain to us how you envision this report to read.
Mr. Spies.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, thank you for the question. As you and the committee knows, and you especially as former chair, there are grant reports that each program has to submit. Each grantee has to submit a grant report to the administering agency, as well as the agency gives a summary report to the legislative committees that have jurisdiction. What this accountability report would do, that Pelsby would be responsible for pulling together with the help of the Minnesota Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education, would be every single program that has an expressed, explicit intent to increase teachers of color that receive state funding would have an accountability to be included in this, and that's what all those statutes are. Those statutory numbers are the programs that have state monies tied to them and explicit purposes of addressing an attempt to try to increase teachers of color in the state. So it, for the first time, would collate all of these different reports into one massive report that helps us track as a state whether or not we're making progress in increasing the percentage.
So, Madam Chair.
Mr. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Spies. That's helpful. Looking at what the board must report, what Pelsby must report, on the effectiveness of the state-funded programs to increase, and then you've got recruitment, preparation, licensing, hiring, and retention of racially and ethnically diverse teachers, and then the state's progress toward meeting or exceeding the goals of this section. Did you visit with Pelsby about how they will measure or determine the measurement of all of these areas? Is that something that they're ready to do, or do they need more specificity?
Mr. Spies.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, Mr. Liuzzi.
Mr. Liuzzi, would you like to join us, please, at the table?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we did work with the executive director on this language, but I'll let him speak for himself in terms of what he thinks about an approach.
Mr. Liuzzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, Alex Liuzzi, executive director of Pelsby. Welcome back. Everybody. So for this report, when we saw this language, we saw it similar to what we had been instructed to do in a 2017 legislation around a report looking at special education licensure. And what with that language, what we were able to do is bring together a lot of stakeholders that, in their conversations, tried to figure out what is the best way to measure in each of these different pieces. So we have expertise in just a couple of those statutes and really would look at to the Office of Higher Education, the Department of Education, DEED, and other agencies to help say to show us with the monies that they're receiving in their areas what would be good measures for those, and then come together with those experts to come up with some reasonable measures for that report. So we like the language that brings all of these groups together to sort of come up with a common solution.
Representative Erickson, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then you're going to make recommendations from the stakeholder group or whomever?
Mr. Lizzi?
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding is, yes, not only that the stakeholder group, but from those agencies, they would come together for a collective recommendation. The recommendation would not be Pelsby's recommendation. We would just be facilitating the conversation with the other agencies.
Representative Erickson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the 2019 report is going to make a determination as to whether or not a state advisory council should be established. So you think you're going to gather enough information by just looking at this 1 year?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lindsay.
Thanks, Representative. Possibly not. I think that would be a starting point, and I think a recommendation from this committee might be that we need an additional year to collect all of the information needed to be able to come up with that advisory group, if that advisory group's needed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any other further questions from the table? Sorry, so many moving parts today. All right, then. I think we're going to continue on with the folks that have signed up to testify. So why don't we go to Mr. Heller. And then afterwards, I've got Cindy Christ and Jose Avalar. Mr. Heller, state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, Chair. My name is Rick Heller. I officially represent people with print disabilities and Twice Exceptional, found in House File 1350 on line 1.18. People with print disabilities found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act, 2008, as well as in the IDEA 2004 Federal Act. Regarding Bill 1711, on page 2 of the on page 2 of the bill summary, under textbooks, I believe it's in 4.31 to 3.2, and then 5.1 to 5.4 to 6. And when we talk about textbooks and electronic, it has to do with people with print disabilities. I find nothing in statute regarding that. It's relevant because they are for the students to use. And I believe Ms. Erickson got the flow chart from the department about the decision tree. And currently that's not expressed in the current redrafted special education forms, that those protections are in place to flag parents that there's a checkbox that consider a print disability. Yet they are required to consider assist technology, yet it doesn't get into the what and for what type of audience. One thing about item 11, now we're using general education revenue for kindergarten. That's 8.7, 8 through 9 on the big document. At some point, when are we going to use screening for gifted students that are also considered twice exceptional, Minnesota Statute 120B15? When we get into outcomes for evidence based on Section 12 on lines 8, 11, and then 8, 24 through 25, it's my understanding that the world's best workforce, school districts are required in their full report to identify the outcomes for people that are gifted. How does that fit into the grant application process? And for the record, the 50, the world's best workforce summaries are required to be accessible to the State Department based on 508 and web content accessibility guidelines. However, the full report are not. Until you require that's when you provide more engagement and fairness to people to access those reports, school districts are required to put that online.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I think I gave you about 3 minutes here, and I need to move on to other testifiers. Did you want to wrap it up?
If we can go to page 14 of the summary on individual education programs, 7331 and then 764. It's my understanding, not on the special education forms, is there a place that flags a student that has to have a functional behavior assessment when they have a comprehensive evaluation? That needs to be on that form. The alternate dispute resolution could be a checkbox on the in the process if you want to eliminate paperwork, since they have to opt in now, not opt out. I think that's a relevant piece that's following underneath. That's on 7626.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I think we can move on to the other testifier. I've given you more time than others, so thank you. Maybe we can take some of your other concerns offline. Thank you. I have Cindy Christ up, and then Jose Avalar, and then Lila Fatehi. Ms. Christ, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Christ from MACTE, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Knowing that some of you have probably heard from me as many times as you like to, I signed up for today hoping we could get one of our students here to share their perspective with you. But between academic and work schedules and spring breaks on some campuses, I wasn't able to do that, so you're stuck with me. MACTE and its 31 college and university members wish to express our support for House File 1711, and particularly for the provisions reflecting the work of the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. The provisions from House File 1415, making some changes in the board and operations of Pelsby, and the licensure changes from House File 1329. Some of you have heard me address similar provisions during previous sessions and hearings, so I'm going to focus on just a few issues I heard raised yesterday. First, we wish to express our strong support for an array of provisions designed to address the current problems facing our school districts as they seek to find qualified teachers for their classrooms. I want to echo Representative Erdahl's impassioned remarks yesterday, in which he noted that the problem isn't so much one of not being able to get enough individuals into and through the pipeline, but in keeping them in the classroom. There have been a number of analyses showing that there are more individuals in Minnesota holding valid teaching licenses than there are teaching positions. Clearly, a large part of the solution lies in making teaching a more desirable profession, in which individuals are mentored as they join the profession, allowed to function as professionals, adequately compensated, provided a supportive and appropriate environment in which to work, and given the respect they deserve for the critical work they do. However, there are not enough teachers of color to reflect the diversity of students in Minnesota classrooms. That really is a shortage. And as you know, there are a variety of provisions, important provisions in this bill to address recruitment, preparation and retention of a more diverse teaching force, including the financial supports needed to help individuals access and complete licensure programs. Regarding licensure, many have suggested that we should allow some time for the current new structure to work. I would respectfully disagree. There is a large body of research demonstrating the positive impact on student learning of being taught by fully prepared, high-quality teachers. MACTE repeatedly shared such research results through the process of developing the current system, so this isn't something that's new from us, and we urge that any new structure not sacrifice high standards in the process of providing more flexibility, and our position has not changed. We believe that the 8 years of teaching possible under Tier 1 and Tier 2 licenses under this bill should be sufficient for any individual who wishes to attain a Tier 3 license to complete an approved preparation program, be it by taking classes on campus or online or from the growing array of programs offering approved licensure programs in the state. And this is no less true for teachers of color than for any of their colleagues. Also, we strongly support removal of lines 38.2 38.23, as reflected in the bill, so that a Tier 3 license reflects successful completion of all of the standards of effective practice that reflect your expectations of and requirements for licensure. So in other words, I'm supporting that change that's in there. I'm not suggesting it's something different. I realized as I was reading that it didn't sound very clear. Finally, a question was posed yesterday about the potential impact of the proposed licensure changes on Grow Your Own programs. I was sitting here yesterday with my colleague Laura Mogelson, who testified before you last week on House File 1329, and who runs some Grow Your Own programs for the University of Minnesota. And she assured me that the proposed changes in this bill would have no negative impacts on Grow Your Own programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Alvilar, please state your name for the record and pronounce it correctly so I can learn and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jose Villar, and I'm the Education Justice Organizer for Navigate Minnesota. But I'm here today not just as an organizer or as an educator, but as someone who has gone through the entire public school system in the state of Minnesota, in particularly supporting the ethnic studies and culturally relevant provisions under this bill. When I was in high school, I, like many others, was required to take social studies courses. Of course, granted that those were graduation requirements, so it's not like I could say no. However, when I took my world history course, I was expecting world history, a history of the world as it related to cultural awareness and understanding, but it was anything but. Instead, I read the history of the world through a deficit lens that spoke of people of color and indigenous communities as something from the past. I identify as Mexica. My ancestral lineage is Pochteca, Otomi, and Anahuac. So when my class began to study the Aztec culture, I was enthusiastic, seeing others in books that looked like me, but the stories were not uplifting. And I looked at my people and my people were looked at through this demonizing nature. My people were spoken of as if we were extinct and as if we were something from the past. I quickly spoke about these false stories, but I was quickly told to stay quiet and that I was the one lying. Then I was told by my peers that Aztecs don't exist anymore, but I am here today and so is my community. So how do we explain that to a young Mexica and Aztec children? Are we to tell them that they don't exist when they are the living example and breathing example of our existence? But this story is not just unique to the Latinx experience. This is true for many other communities of color and indigenous folks. We are not communities relegated to be in textbooks as an extinct species, because we are not. Nor should we be subjected to the dehumanization nature of this rhetoric that is further perpetuated by our education system. What we need is prepared educators who understand cultural humility. What we need are educators who have similar lived experiences and upbringing, such as those described through the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Teachers Act. What we need is ethnic studies pedagogy that centers the lives of our diverse schools and benefits all students in understanding such diverse communities through a critical lens, regardless of race, class, or gender. Because our students deserve to have their lives validated, not just by their families and their communities, but by their schools and their teachers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Alvear. I have next Leah Bate and Jim Bartholomew, and then we'll break for questions. Ms. Fati here to talk about... Oh, perfect. There you are. I'm like looking. All right. Proceed. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laylee Fadahi. I represent Decoding Dyslexia of Minnesota. First, thank you for the inclusion of the provisions for dyslexia screening in the bill. This is compromise language. Actually, it's not compromise language. It's just plain old better language that we were able to arrive at with input and assistance from the department, MSBA, MREA, the Association for School Administrators and Edmin, as well as legislative staff. So many thanks to all those parties. I am perplexed, however, that some of these groups testified yesterday as to their concerns about the potential costs of the dyslexia screening provisions. I'm assuming that their concerns are more general in nature and not specific to this bill language. because all parties, by my recollection, mostly acknowledge that the bill imposes no to minimal additional requirements on top of what the great majority of school districts are already doing in the way of screening students. In fact, the language is doesn't impose any particular requirements for a type of screening to be used. It just provides that the screening that's already happening, the dyslexia characteristics, should be looked for and reported. I also wanted to respond to a couple of concerns we heard about yesterday in regards to whether we may end up screening students over and over again and the potential for that to traumatize students of color. Again, I'm assuming that these concerns are more general and not specific to this bill language. The language about unless another cause for the reading deficiency, that so-called exit ramp language, was included in the bill specifically to avoid that situation where a student ends up being screened over and over again. Furthermore, you know, it's students of color, especially low-income students of color, who are most in need of this bill and the screening that it provides, those whose parents do not have the resources, spend thousands of dollars to have their child screened for dyslexia. And these students often are already being traumatized, either by being incorrectly identified as having special needs and being routed into special needs programs when they are in fact dyslexic, or if their dyslexia is not being caught, just being labeled as lazy or unintelligent. And so we appreciate the inclusion of the screening language. We look forward to continuing to work with you and the other parties.
Thank you, Ms. Fatahi. I'm sorry, I'm not doing very well on pronouncing names today. Mr. Bartholomew. And he's not here. So, why don't we do one more? We'll do Jill Newbell. Is she here from Forest Lake Schools? And then we'll break for some questions. See if Mr. Bartholomew shows up or not. I know there's a lot of other committees going on, so people may be stuck in other places. So, Jill Newbell, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Jill Newbell.
Proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here to testify on the short-term objective provision. I am a speech-language pathologist, and I have been for 22 years. I cover ages preschool to age 21, so I have quite the gamut of students that I work with. It gives me a unique perspective as I'm able to work with many special ed teachers and many parents. This is weird. I have to like do the cheaters and I can't see you. I'm here to tell you that without a doubt, the paperwork work is a big roadblock for many teachers. We are unable to keep teachers. People aren't coming into teaching. I just heard somebody say, we have so many teachers. We have more licensed teachers not teaching than open positions. This is a huge thing, this paperwork. How do we streamline it? How do we get it so we are making jobs easier for folks in my position? It's because of paperwork that we have less time to communicate with parents. It's because of paperwork that we have less time to collaborate with other professionals. It's because of paperwork that we have less time prepping. So as you see, it's all going back to paperwork. And in the end, it affects the kids the most. I mean, sure, I spend a lot of time on paperwork, but I can handle it. It's my kids. It's what I don't get to do for the kids because I'm fulfilling these obligations that are way above what the federal law expects of us. I'm here today in support of the provision included in this bill to allow short-term objectives to be optional for the IEP team if the parent approves. Decreasing and streamlining paperwork is what's best for kids and teachers, and that's why I'm here today. I testified a few weeks ago, and I support it because we are losing so many teachers that it takes all of that time to retrain people. I'm retraining new special ed staff all of the time, and I'm a speech therapist, so it just gets to be very wearing on a staff. Making short-term objectives optional with the consent and acknowledgement of the team, which includes the teachers and the parents, empowers everyone, teachers and parents alike, and we can have meaningful conversations about what is best for the student, because after all, that is why we're all here. We're here for the students. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you, Chair Joaquim, including this provision in your omnibus bill, and thank you, Representative Howard, for chief authoring the bill.
Thank you. And I think we'll break for member questions. Is there any members at the table that have questions for any of the testifiers we just had? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy Christ and Alex Luizzi again.
Mr. Luizzi and Ms. Christ, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So, Ms. Christ, what does MACD do to recruit teachers of color?
Well,
Ms. Christ?
It's a whole array of things. Paul may actually be able to answer that question better than I, but I know that there are particular programs on many of the campuses to do just that. And I can certainly get back to you with more details. It's not something that I've looked at recently. I know, for example, MSU Mankato, there are some programs that they put in place, I think that started while they had the Bush grant, that were targeted not just at recruiting broadly, but also recruiting candidates of color. I know the number of the private colleges in the Twin Cities work very hard at that. St. Cloud State, I know, has some programs. So I think there are a wide array of them. But I apologize that I can't be more specific or explicit with you about that right now. I don't know.
Paul, Mr. Spies is coming down.
I know it's not my responsibility to ask somebody else, but thinking sort of the spirit of phone a friend, he might be able to give you some more specific examples if that's
Mr.
all right.
Mr. Spies, if you can quickly answer that, and then we'll move on.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, there's a whole range of things that MACD members are doing, representing 31 different teacher prep programs. 15% of all the teacher candidates in the state right now in fall of 2018 were candidates of color. And 11% of all the completers, about 376 in total, were of color in 2018. So it's a much higher percentage than the 4% overall that represent the teacher workforce. But And to move the needle, we need 630 net gain just to move the needle from 4% to 5%. So through Grow Your Own programs, through concurrent enrollment courses, through the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educator of Color Program grants, there are a variety of things that are happening all throughout the whole state.
Representative Erickson. Hello.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Christ, do the MACD programs focus on the cultural differences the candidate will face? And then I have another question, too, about special ed. Do your candidates know that there's a paperwork load waiting for them when they enter the classroom as a special ed teacher?
Ms. Christ.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Our colleges, universities focus on diversity in at least two ways. One is to seek to prepare all candidates to effectively teach and work in culturally diverse environments. And then the other is to attract more individuals of color into the program, their programs, and provide them with the support they need to the extent that they have the resources to complete those programs. I think that answers your first question.
So,
Representative Erickson?
So, Ms. Christ, do you offer particular courses that are studies of various cultures or when it's an elementary teacher, is the Child Lit course, which I believe the candidates have to take, maybe more than one, does that focus on a variety of stories from cultures? Or, how do you get this understanding in the candidate's mind and ready for the workplace?
Ms. Christ.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I'm sure there are both standalone courses and many courses in which the standards are embedded. As you know well, in a standards-based environment, the programs don't provide evidence of meeting the standards simply by saying, we have this course in this area, this course in this area, but they take all of the standards, and I think there are standards that address diversity in a number of places within the SEPs. So some of them are embedded in other courses, like, you know, we used to call Kitty Lit courses when I was preparing to be a teacher, you know, social studies courses, an array of courses, but also in courses about pedagogy and child development and so on. So again, you know, with 31 colleges and universities, there isn't a single answer. But to be approved, they all have to demonstrate through the, as you well know, the Pelsby process, that all of those standards are placed in their courses and they provide evidence that candidates have met all of those standards before they're recommended for licensure.
Representative Erickson, did you have a follow-up question for Ms. Louie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How about the special ed question? Do your candidates know they're going to face an enormous amount of paperwork when they enter the classroom?
Ms. Chris.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm sure that that's covered a great deal. Yes. There are a lot of things, especially toward the end of a program. As I recall from when I was in a preparation program, a number of things, especially toward the end, sort of addressing a number of things about realities of actually being in a classroom. This is part of why I was hoping we'd have a student here, because they would be able to tell you from their own particular experiences how that happens. But yes, we do. You know, our programs do many things to try to help their candidates understand the realities of the environment in which they're going to be teaching. However, I think with all of us, sometimes we can't fully comprehend that until we're actually in the classroom and dealing with it. But our programs do whatever they can to help our candidates be prepared for the environment in which they'll be teaching.
Representative Erickson, did you have a follow-up for Mr. Luisi?
Well, I was going to ask for Mr. Luisi then. On the standards of effective practice, as your members, your board members, are evaluating those programs, do you see that essence of cultures as they pervade our state embedded in those standards, or is this something that has to be learned on the job or through extra reading or some other way?
Mr. Leedsy.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. There's two parts to a review process. So the standards of effective practice have to be evidenced through the when they submit a licensure program. So we look at how those standards are met through courses and experiences. And as we see alternative pathways coming, we're seeing a lot of those standards being met more through experiences and field experience type placements. But I think what you're addressing more right now is really the unit standards, which we are revisiting, because there's one standard that says the teacher preparation provider must have culturally relevant pedagogy throughout their program. That's one of 54 standards, and then one about recruiting diverse candidates and one about recruiting diverse faculty. Because of the passage of 122A.2451, the alternative pathway statute, we're revisiting those unit standards to make sure they're all encompassing, first of all, and second of all, that they're meeting the current needs. And one of the big changes is to make that section a little bit more robust, so that when we visit the preparation providers, we're not just looking at it as one standard, but really embedded throughout the program. And I can say, having been on 10 to 15 site visits myself, it does vary tremendously how many embedded throughout their program to make sure that candidates are leaving with that experience, and how many of it is in versus just one course.
Representative Erickson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll switch topics now, Mr. Luisi, to how many state boards have an even number of board members?
Mr. Luisi?
I will. Madam Chair, Representative, I will have to check on that. I was a math teacher for 6 years. You'd think that, you know, we could go from 11 to 14. I would have realized what an even number would have done. So thank you for that question. But I do not know how many other states have an even number.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Luisi, when we vote here, if it's a tie, it fails. So I don't know if you practice that, but that's what we practice here.
Representative Erickson, another follow-up, and I've got some other people on the list.
No, I'll stop there. Thank
you. Okay, Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Luisi and Ms. Christ. And Mr. Cease.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. I had a quick question for maybe somebody from the Board of Teaching. Somebody wants to stay up. Wonderful. So just a quick question. I know that we're always trying to look at who might be missing in our in the teaching profession, and I'm just curious if we have any twice exceptional teachers that are currently teaching or who have licenses, and then what are our other things that we're doing in order to recruit teachers who might bring a different lens into the profession. I'm just curious.
Ms. Lietzi.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. The Board of Teaching doesn't exist anymore, so I will say that we're Pelsby. We're trying to shed that old name. It's hard, you know. Yes, but thank you for the question. So, of the two questions, one, we don't have a lot of data on specifically when we dig down into who's in the teaching force right now. The data that we do have is reported from districts on what is called a STAR report. The district tells us just the race and ethnicity of the teachers in the classroom. So we would have no evidence of how many are twice exceptional. It's an interesting question, and I think what has some of the conversations that have come up since we've had the teacher supply and demand report is that it might be good to get more information on who's teaching, who has left the profession and why they've left the profession, some type of teacher survey as well, and that could dig into some of those pieces. Pelsby doesn't have a direct role in recruiting teachers. We do, however, see ourselves as, because of we're an advocate for the profession as well, to work with districts, preparation providers, individuals who are currently in the classroom to make sure that they feel supported, that they have pieces. So one of the pieces that the board has, it's only been around for a year now, has done is to develop a cultural competency training that we're providing to districts free of charge. We've taken in experts on cultural competence, hopefully to start building more of that community, that school climate that is more welcoming to diverse teachers to start changing that a bit. But other than that, we don't have any direct pieces that we do.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I just have a general comment about the cultural competence piece, or what I say cultural humility, because no one is ever culturally competent. It was refreshing listening to a young person, I think he's younger than me, a younger person talk about how like people of color don't exist in civics and history, because as a young person once in a long time ago, I felt that. I came from a continent that was predominantly black. I came to this country, and my world changed overnight. And everything black in the history was vilified, ostracized. Either you hear about, you know, slavery and two great heroes. That was the only black history that you would get. So when we are talking about this cultural competence, and do we have teachers who are culturally competent? We don't. So even today, like my son is 15 years old, and we had conversation about prison system, and he was making calculation in his head. It's like, Mom, how does 15% of the population make up about 65% of the people in prison? I'm like, I don't know. He was like, mathematically, that doesn't make any sense. Well, I'm like, yeah, it doesn't, because it should not make any sense. So we are not teaching our kids from the time I was going to school and previous people from today. We still don't have cultural teachers who have cultural humility, who are intentional. And if we do, we don't have enough of them. So whatever program that we're doing out there has to intentionally include cultural humility and teachers who are intentional about what they're teaching students. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. We're going to go to, does anyone remember questions? Otherwise, I'm going to go to some more testifiers. I still don't see Mr. Bartholomew. Is Shannon Mitchell here? Last call for both of you. All right, we are going to move on then. I have, let's see, Barb Saunders, Marty Schofield, Nancy Cordes, and then Hong Murphy. And then we'll be done. Oh, sorry, I had Nancy Cordes already went. Sorry. So, Barb Saunders, Marty Schofield, and then Hong Murphy.
Okay, so I'm Marty Schofield.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. As I said, my name is Marty Schofield, and I'm here to testify on the ECFE ABE provision in this bill. I teach adult basic education at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Lionel Lakes, and I've been a teacher there since 2000. I work with adult male students in an education system that is unique. My students are between the ages of 17 to over 70. Most of them are working on earning the GED or completing high school. Last year, nearly 600 students earned their secondary credential in Minnesota prisons. We all know that furthering your education is the key to a better life. What may be less obvious is that for every level of education an inmate completes, they are less likely to return to prison. I would like you to know that as a licensed teacher, the exclusion of early childhood and adult education teachers is unjust. Despite being fully licensed, I do not have the same continuing contract rights as my K-12 colleagues. At a time when the state is struggling to retain teachers, there's even a greater need to retain both early childhood and adult educators. One part of the solution to this problem is to respect all teachers, the professionals that they are, and treat them with the courtesy that they deserve. Both ECFE and ABE teachers are often told that they are respected. The reality is, state law says otherwise. I urge you to change the current state law and remove the exclusion of ECFE and ABE teachers from obtaining continuing contract status. It is the equitable and right way to show your respect to me and my colleagues. I want to thank you, Representative Lee, for chief authoring the bill, and Chair Joaquin for including this provision in this omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Schofield. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Barbara Saunders. I'm currently in my 25th year as an ECFE family educator with the Spring Lake Park School District, and I love my job. Today I'm here to testify on the ECFE and ABE provision in this bill. One of my greatest passions involves working with the littlest of learners. Children are born ready to learn. It is amazing to witness over and over again the phenomenal amount of growth, brain development, and learning that happens in the first few years of life. In early childhood family education, or ECFE, we teach infants, toddlers, preschoolers, and, equally important, their parents. ECFE is designed to give parents the tools, support, and information they need to help their child succeed in life. ECFE, which has been in existence for 45 years, is unique to Minnesota. This nationally celebrated model supports the essential role of parents in the lives of young children. ECFE is available to everyone in all Minnesota school districts. The legislators that first established ECFE back in the 1970s should be commended for their foresight in recognizing the importance of early childhood and parent education. By law, ECFE and ABE teachers are required to have at least a four-year college degree and be fully licensed, just as their K-12 colleagues are. We also need to renew our licenses every 5 years. We are Tier 4 teachers under the new tiered licensure system. Tier 4 requirements also state that these teachers have a continuing contract, except ECFE and ABE teachers do not have continuing contract. That is what I'm asking you to fix today and support the provision to include ECFE and ABE teachers under the continuing contract statute. I'm very concerned that many younger teachers, despite having a passion for little learners and or parent education, are not going into early childhood education because of the inequities they would face. ECFE teachers need to know that they are respected at the same level as their K-12 and ECSE colleagues, and making that change would put them under the continuing contract statute, will show them that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I want to thank Representative Lee for being the chief author on this bill, and thank you, Chair Joaquin, for including this in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Ms. Saunders. Last person I have on our list is Hung Murphy. And then after that, we will move to some member questions. Mr. Murphy, please state your name for the record, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So my name is Hung Murphy, and if you say Hung, you won't say it wrong.
That's cool.
Thank you. I'm the founder and executive director of Foster Advocates. We are a nonprofit that works to engage folks who have experienced the foster care system to make sure that when we are discussing policies that affect us personally, that we are the experts in our own lives and should be the experts in the policy changes that are being promoted. And so in that work, we are here to support what used to be 1883, but it's now House File 1171, and we'd like to just take a quick moment to thank the chair for her support of foster youth. We're often not included in many conversations, that when we talk about students and we talk about vulnerable children, we don't speak about the most vulnerable, children where the state is literally their parent and their caretaker. And we don't do enough to help them. I think this might change soon, so thank you for your support. And I look forward to working with everyone to improve on this work and moving forward. I would also like to thank our author, Representative Koitza Withoon. Thank you for prioritizing foster youth and their need for minimizing absences and continuity in education, especially as they move from setting to setting. The hardest thing that you can do is change a family, to change a household, to be transient, and move school districts. We'd like to see where we can students stay in their home district whenever possible, where teachers know who they are, where a caring adult will see them every day, and where they get to just be a kid. And if they cannot stay in that home school, that they are enrolled as quickly as possible in a school that can support them, in a school that will provide them with some stability. So I don't want to take up the full 2 minutes because I know you all have busy schedules, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. With that, members, do we have anybody at the table that has questions for this last group of testifiers? Anybody? All right, then I think I'll move on to announcements. So tomorrow's meeting, we'll start taking up amendments, and everybody better eat their Wheaties because I think there's 28 posted. So we're going to meet at our regular time at 2:30 to 4 in this room. And then Thursday, from 9:45 to 11:15, we will be here. We're taking Education Finance's spot. They graciously gave up their room. And then we'll be coming back again if we have to Thursday night from 6 to 10 in this room as well. And then I had a question for Representative Erickson if she's okay with this. I've been always trying to post stuff at least 5 days out ahead of time. But one of your bills, House File 761, and one of Representative Hassan's bills, 1111, I'd like to take up on Thursday and move them to the General Registry, just in case something goes awry with Omnibus Bill. I think they're two very important provisions we need to get done this year. Representative Erickson, would you be okay with us posting that for Thursday?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you remind us what 1761 is?
761, Representative Erickson, it's your bill on the homeless transportation, homeless youth transportation.
And the other one?
Representative Hassan, 1111, is the one on changing the PSEO standard for Summit Academy.
And, Madam Chair, is there a reason that you want to move the homeless separately?
I just would like to move both of them to the floor so maybe we can, just to make sure that they get done this year. So if we get pushed with a time crunch, I know, especially with the PSA 01, they need to have it done by this fall.
Certainly. Thank you.
All right. And we'll post those and inform the authors. Otherwise, with that, we're adjourned.